This is the IBJ podcast for the week of January 3rd, 2022, brought to you by Taft. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, editor of IBJ, in this week for Mason King. This is the first week of January in a new year, but we're going to use this time to talk about 2021, and we're going to explore the year by looking at the people IBJ has named its Newsmakers of the Year. I'm joined by some top-notch IBJ journalists to talk about the headlines and the headliners. Here's our conversation. I'm excited today to be joined by three of our great IBJ staff members. We have Dave Lindquist, who covers retail and the arts for IBJ. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Leslie. It's good to be here.
And we have Mickey Shuey, who is our real estate reporter, also covers the business of sports and tourism. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Greg Weaver, our managing editor, who is a longtime political editor and came to us earlier this year. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thanks for having me, Leslie.
So I thought we could structure today's discussion about the past year by looking at the newsmakers that IBJ named in just the last few days. So IBJ has always done a year in review and talked about or written about some of the people who were in the news. But this year we formalized that a little bit and named actual newsmakers. I think it's really important to say from the outset that we focused on people that made a positive impact in some way on business or in the community. There are certainly lots of options for newsmakers if we wanted to go with folks who were just in the news, but that wasn't what we decided to do for our year in review, which is part of the book, which we used to call the Book of Lists. Now it's just the book. So let's go through some of those folks and use that to talk about the year. And we'll start with our actual newsmaker of the year, who was Ryan Vaughn, who is the president of the Indiana Sports Corp. Mickey, you cover sports and the NCAA, and so I think you can tell us, why was Ryan Vaughn the newsmaker of the year?
Well, there's many things to list off for that, not the least of which is the fact that he led the charge to bring the entire NCAA men's basketball tournament to Indiana, most of which in Indianapolis. First time that has ever happened in tournament history that a single state has hosted the entire tournament. And it came at a time where Indianapolis was really looking to make its mark during the height of COVID. It showed the trust that the NCAA has in Indianapolis to pull off big events. I mean, the city's already hosted 7 or 8 Final Fours, and this was certainly the biggest event that they've ever entrusted Indianapolis with. And he and his team and the host committee really pulled off something that not a lot of other cities arguably could have done.
This, of course, was the result of COVID. This was a response to the pandemic. The NCAA decided it could control the situation much better if it put everything in one place, you know, more or less one place, rather than being spread out across the country for the various rounds. And so that meant a sort of bubble environment. Greg, how did the city of Indianapolis do in terms of pulling off this tournament?
Oh, I think the city did really well, and that only serves to, you know, increase and enhance its reputation that it can host these kinds of events even during a pandemic. And that's become increasingly important as the pandemic has dragged on. And so it'll serve the city well, even in the coming months, as we continue to try to figure out how to navigate and maneuver, you know, through the pandemic itself.
Dave, you cover retail. You joined IBJ in late in the year. And so you were not covering this tournament or the impact on retailers. But I wondered if you have any thoughts about what it meant to businesses in Indianapolis to be able to host this event. Did it provide at least some lift?
Actually, I was downtown many days in March and April. And the thing in my mind is I just see fans in Loyola gear walking the streets of Indianapolis. I mean, the proximity of Chicago helped with that. But the whole tournament felt like a lifeline to the city when it really needed it. From the basketball standpoint, to have only one game forfeited because of ineligibility due to COVID is pretty remarkable. Right now, we're seeing these college football bowl games play out, and they've already had 7 cancellations. It's not a bubble situation, but I think it is a testament to how well the model worked here in Indianapolis.
So talking about the NCAA tournament brings us actually to another one of our newsmakers, and that is Mally Jeffers and Alan Bacon, who started a group called Gang Gang. They were part of bringing an arts festival to downtown Indianapolis during the NCAA tournament. Dave, I know you've written about Gang Gang. Can you talk a little bit about them and what they did for the NCAA, but in general, what they're doing?
Sure. Well, let's start on the tournament, since that's where we were. The Arts Council of Indianapolis was the overarching organizer of something called SWISH, the Arts and Culture Festival, that placed like 600 different artists on street corners and makeshift venues all over downtown during the tournament. And they enlisted Gang Gang, Alan and Molly, with hiring acts for much of this. And from my corner of the world, this is the story of the year. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in Indianapolis. It would be great to see this replicated here again or in other cities. Coming out of, you know, the racial justice emphasis of 2020, the Arts Council and Gang Gang made a concerted effort that people of color and artists of color would be a big part of the SWISH Festival. And in the numbers, it was like 50%. You know, I've talked to people about how remarkable that was. And one thing that sticks with me is people saying, you know, it's possible to have an event with participants that look like your community. That's basically Gang Gang's mission. They've definitely made a mark in the city, and they've got a lot of support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, and they've just got a great network, and I'm looking for big things for them in 22 as well.
Greg, it feels like what happened during the NCAA tournament and the arts were really a direct result of what happened in 2020 in reaction to the George Floyd murder in Minnesota. Can you talk about why that it was important for the community to embrace a diverse cultural event at this time?
Yeah, I think it shows that the community is concerned and devoted to diversity, and it kind of displays that to the rest of the world. I also think that the arts provide some like common ground for everyone, that there are things that everyone can relate to, no matter who is producing the art, you know, whether it's a visual art or it's a live performance. Those are things that anyone can grasp onto. And I think the other thing that the arts do is they help us deal with our emotions and explore our emotions in a deeper way. And I think that was very important in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, and also just in like trying to deal with all the complications of the pandemic itself. And so it helped deal with all of those things.
So talking about Gang Gang actually leads us into yet another one of our newsmakers, because Gang Gang, the Mally Jeffers and Alan Bacon, had been guest curators, I believe I'm using the right language there, of an exhibit that was planned at Newfields, at the Indianapolis Museum of Art at Newfields. They actually pulled out of that when there was a race controversy at Newfields, which was a huge story this year. And Mickey, I know you were involved in covering that. Can you talk a little bit about what happened?
Sure. So earlier this year, then CEO Charles Venable was ultimately dismissed from his post, or resigned from his post, however you want to look at it, after a job description was put out for the museum that focused on the core white audience, is how they described it in the job listing. And that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because it seemed like they were trying to kind of cut out individuals of color who might enjoy the museum or might otherwise be targeted through marketing for the museum. And so that raised a big kerfuffle in the arts community and the community at large, because Newfields has not always necessarily been known for embracing diversity. It's had a lot of exhibits from white artists and non-diverse artists. So that just kind of was another, it was a compounding factor on top of what had already been going on there. including a lot of accusations of racial discrimination from a previous curator that came out last year. So as part of that, Gang ultimately withdrew its support and involvement in a curated exhibit focused on Black artists, on artists of color, and ultimately went a different route. I believe they're now back in conversations with Newfields about how to re-engage and re-up that involvement. But it was a big issue at the time.
So if we were Time Magazine, or if we were doing things for our Newsmakers of the Year differently, Charles Venable probably would have been the Newsmaker of the Year in this case. But because we really wanted to focus on positive impact in the community, the person we actually chose was Darian Christian, who was a board member at Newfields and then kind of emerged during this controversy and helped lead the reaction to it. And eventually they made her chair of the board, and she is the first Black woman to lead Newfields. Dave, are we seeing some changes there, or is it too soon to know?
First of all, it's difficult for me to believe that 2021 was the year that this happened. So many things happened this year that the Venable exit seems farther away in time than maybe it was. I think there's a lot of work to be done for Newfields to bolster its reputation as an inclusive, welcoming place. I don't know if we've seen it yet, but I think they've made initial steps that do give people the feeling that they want to give Newfields a shot.
So I think we might be done with the connectedness of all of our various newsmakers, but I'm going to give this one a shot in that just as Darian Christian was the first Black woman to lead Newfields, Pamela Witten is the first woman to lead Indiana University. And I use long storied history. Pam Witten is the first woman to serve as president. And that alone really made her a Newsmaker of the Year. Again, we need a little time to see how she's going to change the university. But Greg, why did the IU board say they went with Pam Witten, who had been the president of Kennesaw State University, not a school that falls off the tongue of most Hoosiers?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it did have to do with her experience dealing with issues of diversity and inclusion. And as you noted, first of all, she's a woman, and the university made a statement, I think, by picking a woman to lead the school for the first time. But then beyond that, she dealt with some racial issues at Kennesaw and handled them well. And I think that also elevated her in the eyes of the Board of Trustees. And then, I think she's also very focused on students and the student experience. And she has, a wealth of knowledge in telemedicine and telehealth. And I think that will only serve to elevate, the already storied IU School of Medicine.
As we look to the future of Pam Witten's time as president of IU, I think one of the things that really stands out as an issue for the school is what to do long-term about IUPUI. IUPUI has a little bit of an identity problem. IU is actually completely in charge of IUPUI. Purdue actually has very little to do with it, but is wrapped up in the name. Greg, do you see, especially with Mitch Daniels at Purdue right now, and probably not for a lot longer, do you see that there could be a change at IUPUI? And what would be the reasons for IU to consider it?
Well, I think you've already seen some change in terms of just the approach and the focus of President Witten. I think it's very clear that she's probably spending roughly half her time in Indianapolis and the other half in Bloomington. And I think, previous administrations had left the running of IUPUI largely to the chancellor. So she's definitely going to be more involved in shaping what IUPUI is going to look like going forward. But I also think that there's a great opportunity to brand IUPUI in a more forceful way to, let people know that, it's not just a branch campus of IU Bloomington, but it has the School of Medicine, it has the School of Dentistry, it has a School of Law. It is a huge presence in the city. And I think, through its academic research and even, also through its sports teams, there's an opportunity to elevate its presence nationally, but also to make it more of a force in the city of Indianapolis itself.
Yep. Because of the nature of the school, it's the biggest university in Indianapolis. And yet it doesn't, there's nothing about Indianapolis that feels like it has really a major university. Dave, do you think that elevating the position of IUPUI would be a help to the city of Indianapolis in many ways, all, across all spectrums?
This is an exciting concept that I really haven't thought of. When I think of a twin city or a sister city or a similar city to Indianapolis, I always think of Columbus, Ohio. And what does Columbus, Ohio have that Indianapolis doesn't have? They have the Ohio State University. Certainly, Butler's stature is elevated in Indianapolis when their sports teams do well. Yeah, this is a really exciting concept to me to think of IUPUI becoming a, I guess, residential university is part of this equation, right? If that situation changes or evolves. But yeah, who wouldn't want that type of situation for your city?
Let's take a break to hear from our sponsor.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
We're back. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, editor of IBJ, and I'm joined in this review of 2021 by IBJ managing editor Greg Weaver and reporters Mickey Shuey and Dave Lindquist. So let's switch gears to another one of our newsmakers that I know Mickey can talk about. John Kite leads Kite Realty Group, which made a huge acquisition this year. Mickey, tell us about what Kite's been up to.
In July, Kite announced that it was going to merge, or in many ways acquire, Retail Properties of America, which is an Oak Brook, Illinois, Chicago area based REIT, or real estate investment trust. That move made Kite one of the largest retail real estate firms in the country. It was part of an all-stock deal that was worth just under $3 billion, which is a huge move for the Indianapolis-based firm. Obviously, John Kite is CEO, and that's been part of his mission to first right-size the company over the past few years. But now they are in a growth period where they're making strategic moves to increase their portfolio and improve their portfolio with better and not necessarily upscale, but higher end properties, shopping centers. So this is definitely a big move for them. And it comes at the same time that they're continuing to invest in Indianapolis as well, in a variety of properties they have, including Glendale Town Center by Broad Ripple.
So Mickey, I think one of the most exciting things about this is that the headquarters stays in Indianapolis. That gives Indianapolis two of the largest retail companies in the country, and the executives stay. John Kite remains the leader of the combined company.
After the acquisition, Kite has 185 shopping centers that total 32 million square feet. And that's nothing to scoff at. That's a lot of space, particularly in the retail market right now. The big challenge that they have is figuring out how they utilize all that space, particularly as we try and exit this pandemic, because as we all know, a lot of retailers have gone out and there's been a lot of rethinking of how retail space is used. So the biggest challenge that they're going to have will be how to activate that space and how to make it a long-lasting move.
So I'm going to take a stab at talking about one of our other newsmakers, because I don't think on this group we have a SPAC expert. Our SPAC experts weren't able to join us today, but Bob Lakin is one of our newsmakers of the year. And Bob is part of, I guess you could call it a little bit of a craze that started taking place in 2020, continued into 2021, and is cooling off a little bit. And so a SPAC, a special purpose acquisition company, is a firm that is created. It's a public company that's created by selling shares, but it doesn't own anything. And a SPAC is looking for a company to acquire. and take public through essentially a back door. And so Bob got a group together that raised $100 million. This is in 2020 on their original venture called Novus Capital. And they used that money to acquire App Harvest and take that company public. That's a Lexington company. And then this year, he did a second SPAC, raising $288 million. And in September, they announced that they were going to merge with Energy Vault, which is a fascinating company, and take that company public. Greg, can you tell us a little bit about what Energy Vault does?
Yes. So Energy Vault creates a mechanism that stores renewable energy, both solar and wind, so that it can be kept, you know, in storage during times when wind and solar energy can't be generated, because there are always gaps. The sun's not always shining. The wind's not always blowing. And so these storage units will help fill in those gaps and make renewable energy more reliable across the country. And so it's a really exciting venture. There are a couple other companies out there that are trying to do the same thing, but whoever harnesses that is going to become a major force.
We talked to Bob just a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, and he said he's not sure when his next SPAC will be. The whole industry has cooled off a little bit. It just got so crazy that I think prices got driven up. And so he's waiting to see what his next move will be. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. And then our final newsmaker of the year are the folks at High Alpha. High Alpha is a venture capital studio that nurtures new companies. It creates new companies. The founders are Eric Tobias, Scott Dorsey, Mike Fitzgerald, and Christian Anderson. These are all highly accomplished entrepreneurs in Indianapolis, and they are pumping out companies like crazy. So since their creation in 2015, I think they've spun off some 25 companies. And in 2021 in particular, they closed a $110 million fund that they are using to invest in startups. And then 6 months later, they raised another $18 million, which they will actually use to help prepare companies for that larger amount of venture funding. They created several companies in this year. Also, one of their portfolio companies, Lessonly, was also acquired in a big deal with Seismic, which is a global software firm. But Dave, can you talk about one of their really interesting companies that they actually created in 2020, but is having a big year this year, Mandolin?
Certainly. So in 2020, when stay-at-home orders were everywhere, one of the industries that faced a big challenge was live music. And several startups emerged that year in the live stream space. And one of them was an Indianapolis company that came out of High Alpha called Mandolin. Eric Tobias has a music corner of his life because he's one of the co-owners of The Vogue. And he worked with an attorney named Robert Midas, who happens to be the husband and manager of a singer-songwriter in Indiana, Carrie Newcomer. They were kind of on the ground floor. The company's CEO is Mary Kay Hughes, who came from a Salesforce background. And Mandolin has really done quite well in the live stream space. They've actually acquired a competitor that was based in Chicago. And certainly during the height of the pandemic, the model was pretty straightforward. We'll live stream a performance. And for the viewer at home or on their phone or gathered around a laptop, part of the experience was live chats. So that's kind of fun. It's certainly better than talking at a concert, which we hate. But if you're just live streaming something, you can chat with fellow fans. That was going pretty good for Mandolin. Certainly in 2021, we saw in-person, on-site concerts come back. And to me, one of the intriguing things that Mandolin is doing is trying to take their app to the concert venue. So one of the things I like that they do is say you're on the Mandolin app and your seat is stage left 40 rows back. You can toggle a camera view at some of their shows so you can watch the concert from a different view, which it's kind of geeky, but cool. But I think what consumers really would like is they have something on their app where you don't have to wait in line at the merch table. You can place your order and go to a spot and, hey, here's your t-shirt. For people who have waited in lines at merch tables, that's pretty cool.
I think it's worth noting that Mandolin raised $12.5 million this year. So there's definitely support for the company and interest in the company, even as live music returns. So let's turn our attention for just a short time to folks who didn't make the list, in part because of our effort to focus on positive folks. So Greg, this spat between Governor Holcomb, the legislature, and Todd Rokita actually got its start in 2020 when the governor continued to have emergency orders, put in place mask mandate, did a lot of things that Republicans were really frustrated about. So as they came into 2021, lawmakers wanted to put some restrictions in place, and that kind of got this thing rolling. So Greg, I'm going to let you take it from there. What happened?
Sure. So there were some lawmakers who thought that the governor had overstepped his bounds. And so they decided they wanted to rein him in a bit. And these concerns were largely unspoken because they wanted to keep a good face publicly and try to show that everybody was really getting along on the surface, but that's not really what was going on behind the scenes. And so the lawmakers decided that they wanted to be involved anytime there was this kind of pandemic or emergency. So they passed a law that allows them to call themselves into special session to help deal with these issues. And that's turned into a huge fight because the governor believes that under the Constitution, only he has the authority to call the legislature into special session. So in the end, the legislature passed this law over his veto, and then the governor ended up filing a lawsuit against the legislature to stop its enactment. And then in the course of all of that, the Attorney General, Todd Rokita, sided with the legislature and took up their part and also argued that only he should be the person who represents state government in any of these sort of disputes. So ultimately, the courts decided against Rokita in that argument. And the case now between the legislature and the governor is before the Supreme Court, and so the Indiana Supreme Court. And so we're just waiting now to see what happens going forward. But it still is a cloud that, you know, continues to linger as the pandemic roars on, and the legislature still wants to put its own stamp on how the state responds to the pandemic.
Yeah, we're seeing that play out even with legislation going into the 2022 session, in which lawmakers are trying to put some restrictions on businesses and also want to force the governor to get rid of the emergency orders that he has been, that he keeps renewing. And in fact, he just renewed another one. Greg, this newest activity is happening as we're having a surge in Indiana and across the country. What is Indiana's situation right now in the pandemic in terms of vaccination rates, in terms of cases?
So, you know, cases are soaring at levels that we haven't seen since like almost a year ago. There still continues to be a debate over if the state should impose any new restrictions. The governor has opted not to do that, and instead has been saying that the best way to persuade people to be vaccinated is to do it on a personal level, not to have somebody from the governor's office lecturing them about why they should be vaccinated, but to have friends and family try to persuade their loved ones to get the vaccinations. You know, it's very important for that to happen because right now our vaccination rates are at roughly, you know, 50% or so. And so a large number of Hoosiers are not vaccinated and are unprotected and, you know, are spreading the virus.
Dave, I know you've talked to some of the music folks, the venue folks, about what that low vaccination rate actually means for them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, this is a situation where it's a very practical anecdote. In the concert industry, for tours to travel from state to state and stay on the road and active, it's the artists that are basically demanding of venues, you need to have a health check policy, which means either the person who comes to the show is vaccinated or shows a proof of a negative COVID test within 48 or 72 hours. I've seen people say, oh, these venues are doing it to themselves with these health checks. And actually, it's the artists who are on the road that want to go into a room and feel like they are playing for people who don't have COVID. I recently spoke with Josh Baker, who owns the Hi-Fi and Hi-Fi Annex in Fountain Square. And he was talking to me about like you know, I have no political, there's no political shading to this at all. But the reality is, because Indiana's vaccination rates are languishing at around 50%, he said, you know, when I put a show on sale, half of my audience is gone. And another phenomenon that's affecting concerts, and it may be affecting sporting events too, I'm not really sure, but people who own venues are talking about no shows. Like people who buy tickets, even sometimes buy tickets on the day of an event, and by the time the evening rolls around, they decide, like, you know what, I'm not going to go to that. I feel more comfortable staying at home. It's another barrier to business for these venue owners who say, not only do I have a smaller amount of people who are eligible to come to my show, when people buy tickets and stay home, you know, that affects my bar revenue, that affects my merch revenue. So while there has been a nice comeback in the concert industry and events, in a lot of ways, they still feel hamstrung by the whole pandemic.
So before we wrap up, I just feel like we have to talk briefly about the big event that's coming up here at the beginning of 2022, and that's the College Football National Championship. This podcast will air on Monday. So Monday of the week of the event. And, you know, it's possible between the time that we're recording this and when it airs that everything could change. But Mickey, how is the pandemic affecting whether or not the College Football Championship, which is scheduled for January 10th in Indianapolis, how is the pandemic affecting whether that thing can take place?
Well, it's certainly thrown a wrench into things. As Dave mentioned earlier, already 7 bowl games have canceled this year. Last year, I think there were a couple, but definitely more this year due to outbreaks on various teams. And it also led the College Football Playoff, the national office, to institute new policies related to COVID outbreaks that would essentially create multiple paths. One is if a team can't participate in their game, whether it's the semifinals or national championship, then they forfeit. And if both teams can't participate due to COVID outbreaks, the game would have to be moved to sometime later in the week. They would allow for up to like a 4-day grace period of Monday the 10th through that Friday for the game to be played. But if teams can't go, they're not going to bump it any further. They just called a no contest and not have the championship that year.
So, after all this planning, it's crazy to think that there could be a national champion without actually playing this big game in Indianapolis, which the city has raised millions of dollars to host and has spent a crazy amount of time getting ready for. So, Dave, how devastating would that be for the local economy?
Great, Leslie. Let's look at it from an optimistic perspective. This national championship game could be a nice echo to how 2021 unfolded with the basketball tournament happening here in Indianapolis. Mickey had a story recently that talked about the city's leaders are really hoping that this boost right in January can really set the table for a nice 2022. I don't know. I think the staffs at the University of Michigan and Cincinnati and Georgia and Alabama are hermetically sealing all their guys, and they're going to play these semifinal games, and they're going to come to Indianapolis, and two of those teams are going to play for a national championship.
I love it. I hope it happens. Guys, thank you so much for chatting about the year. I feel incredibly grateful to have all of you on our IBJ staff, and thank you so much, and happy 2022.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Greg, Dave, and Mickey for joining me to talk about 2021. You can read more about IBJ's newsmakers and the biggest stories of last year in the latest issue of IBJ and in the book, a separate publication that subscribers will receive in their mailboxes. In addition, you'll find a story in this week's IBJ about the construction of an Indianapolis manufacturing plant that will produce medical devices for Cook Medical. Bloomington-based Cook is building the plant using only contractors and subcontractors whose owners are people of color, women, veterans, or people with disabilities. Barb Burgetts explains how Cook is making it happen. Plus, Sam Stahl has a story about spending in the home renovation industry. The lockdown in 2020 led many homeowners to make improvements like adding a home office or swimming pool. But even as the lockdown eased and some things returned to near normal in 2021, the spending on home updates has continued. You can read all of these stories and more in the latest issue of IBJ or at IBJ.com. Mason King will be back on the IBJ podcast next week. Join us again then.